was funny. Having a good name, Northwest Search, everyone thought they had heard of me. Like, oh, I think I've heard of you guys. Or, oh, yeah, you've been around a while. And it always kind of cracked me up that picking a good name does help because they think more highly of you.
Right, yeah.
So we kind of gained some early credibility. Again, I got lucky on that one.
In this episode, you'll get to know Paul Freed, the artist of recruiting. And you'll hear the story of how he built the Northwest's most successful executive search firm while still having plenty of time for family and fun. I'm Dave Crenshaw, and this is My Success Show. Welcome back, friends, to the Dave Crenshaw Success Show. This is where I speak to some of the most successful people I've met in my life's journey. And while I'm doing it, I'm looking for universal principles of success to help both you and my family. In case it's your first time here, I'm a best-selling author. I speak around the world to Fortune 500 companies, and I've taught millions of people how to be successful through my online courses. With this show, I wanted to do something lasting that would help my family succeed, and I thought you'd also enjoy learning along with them. In these interviews, I'm seeking out people who have achieved multifaceted success. So success, not just career or financial, but in many areas of their life. And during the interviews, I'm looking for actions that anyone, including you, can take right now to become more successful. So as you listen to today's episode, look for something you can do, an action you can take today, this week, soon, to make my guest's success story a part of your success story. And today's guest is special. He's someone I've known for quite a while. I spent a lot of time working with him as a coach and also getting to know him as a friend. Paul Freed is the managing partner of Heard Freed Hearts with over 25 years of experience in the executive search industry. HFH is the Northwest's leading executive search firm. They've worked with over 400 clients across a mix of industries and roles and was named by Forbes as the top executive search firm in the Northwest 3 years in a row. Paul is an expert and a top-rated global public speaker on the art of recruiting. Paul especially loves spending time with his family, traveling. He's been to 82 countries, as well as skiing, biking, and all sorts of outdoor activities. Paul, it's an honor to have you on the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
You were a coaching client of mine for many years. Gosh, what, six, seven, something like that?
7 years. It was fantastic, Dave. You and I talked about many things on life and work, and I'm very grateful.
Yeah, and we've had an opportunity to connect in person a few times. We first met in Seattle. Speaking at an event there. So I'm really excited to interview you because you're someone that I admire, Paul. You're someone with such a high degree of integrity. And also, you're someone with so much expertise in the field of recruiting. And I think that's something that a lot of people who are listening to this, they want to improve their career. I think they're excited to hear your insight into that.
I think end of the day, the ability to recruit talent to your team and your vision makes the difference. And I've had a front row seat to see a lot of what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. And now we're going to get that insight about recruiting through your story. So I always like to start at the beginning, which is the question that, you know, I think everyone got asked when they were young, which is, what did you want to be when you grew up? I'm talking more like in your teenage years, as you started to form ideas about what would be a good career, was recruiting on the list or were you focused on something else in the beginning?
I grew up in Bend, Oregon, and here in Bend, did my high school. I'm back here now, did a Bend, Seattle, back to Bend trip. But in high school, there was an architecture drawing class that I really liked. And maybe the teacher was just really cool, but I remember really engaging with how to draw buildings and design. And I was kind of nerdy. I was good at math and engineering, and people said I should be an architect. So I thought, okay, this sounds like fun. I enjoy designing things and creating, and the systems thinker and visualize a building. And so that led to an internship my junior year. And I sat down for 3 months with an architect design firm here in Bend and realized I was good at drawing, but you spend most of the day behind a desk. This is pre-AutoCAD. And I realized I like people interaction and creativity more. So I'm glad I checked it out, but I realized that was not my path.
Yeah, I think that's a great story because, you know, the thing that inspired me to create this show was trying to help my kids. My youngest at this moment is 10. And your experience with an internship highlights something, which is, I think at a young age, that's a great time to try different things. Because like you said, you did it and then you realized, wait a minute, this isn't for me. Were there other things that you experimented with during that time when you were young, trying different careers on for size?
I think after watching Top Gun, I wanted to be a pilot or astronaut like a lot of kids.
Yeah.
Actually, I did seriously look at the Naval Academy. So I did take that the next stage and applied there. And I actually flew out to Annapolis as a candidate, walked around the property. The moment of truth was I saw them marching to lunch. And they said, you need to commit the next 20 years of your life to the military. And I sat there, I'm like, I don't think this is me. I think I'm too creative, businessy. And so that was the moment. And I realized I was too tall to be a pilot too. I'm 6'2". So I guess I didn't realize that at the time.
Oh.
So that was another dream, I guess, at the time. But I did explore it, but I realized that's not what I was supposed to do either.
Yeah. Well, as I've come to know you, you're definitely more on the entrepreneurial side. You're someone who likes to create your own rules, attempt different things, play around with structure, and working in the military would not have given you much opportunity for that.
Well, I think even as a kid growing up, I mean, I had a paper route. I remember getting my dirt bike and putting the papers on it and going door to door, having to collect money from people, and people would close their curtains and hide from you to collect money. And you learn all these things as a kid. Actually, I changed the payment system. I had them, if they paid online, I would give them a discount and they all started paying online. I did things differently than any paper route kid had done before. And I learned some stuff from that, which was fun. I also thought about in high school, I wanted to play a sport. I don't know, just maybe you want the Letterman's jacket, I guess. And so I tried out for the tennis team my freshman year, which is funny because I had never played tennis before. And okay. I literally looked up how to play tennis in the encyclopedia the week before and went to my local Bi-Mart and bought a $20 rack with my parents. I showed up as a freshman and I was just determined to figure out how to play. And somehow through grit and a little bit of luck, I actually made the junior varsity team and then ended up being varsity for the last 3 years, which is really funny considering I wasn't anything I'd done before. But I think that's a tendency I think I realized growing up. There's this desire to try new things and take a risk. And I just kind of maybe I just believed I could do it.
I just interviewed somebody who talked about that, actually, Mark Delatour, who's a real estate guy in the Midwest. And he brought up that fact that the family that he was raised in always gave them the feeling that you could do whatever you wanted. Was that sort of the same upbringing? Like, what influence did your family have on you in a way that it sort of dictated what you ultimately did for your career?
Good question. I am very grateful to have two loving parents with me there. And I was oldest of three boys. So it's probably that firstborn type A driver that may be part of it. I don't know. But my mom always just would say, I believe in you. You can do it. I think great things are you will accomplish in your life. And I don't know, maybe I just believed it. You kind of get fed those verbal affirmations along the way. And I think that really did help me. She also pushed me. She said, I expect more. And she was harder on me than my teachers. And that's probably why I graduated valedictorian. I was actually good at test taking. And I think she drove me to succeed and win. But also I felt loved and accepted where I was at. So it wasn't like I needed to do that to earn her love. But I think it did drive me and push me, which I know helped a lot.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. And I think it's something that as we're listening to this, and by the way, part of the thing, Paul, and I think you've listened to some other episodes. I appreciate that. I want the people who are listening to look for something that they can do. And I think right there, the example of your mom, the example of your parents creating that environment that helped you succeed, I think that's something anyone could do as they listen to this. Okay, so you went to the University of Puget Sound. Is that correct?
Correct. The quote, Harvard of the Northwest had very pretty buildings in Tacoma, Washington. And it was just far enough away from Bend, Oregon, where it was this adventure of a big city, but it's still in the Northwest.
What did you initially choose to study when you were there?
So I studied business. They had a business leadership program, which is kind of like an MBA packed into 4 years. We had mentors with us. I was fortunate to have the CEO of Alaska Airlines as my mentor, with him once a month for 4 years with the group. And through him, you got to see, you know, almost felt like Dead Poets Society, like, here's how the real world works and how business really works. And through him, we met some amazing execs, met Howard Schultz, met a bunch of other execs that I would never have met otherwise in college. And we also had a series of speakers that came and spoke to our class. It was a mix, some entrepreneurs, some corporate, and it was a really good chance to test drive a lot of different careers and expand my mind. I'm very grateful for that. That was definitely a big impact on my life.
So I had a similar, it was a little bit different, but in the Marriott School of Management where I went, there was sort of that same thing. And I remember there was a great influence that the speakers had, especially if I had an opportunity to go to lunch with them afterward. As you're reflecting on that time period, can you think of a moment that now in hindsight, you go, wow, that moment that I learned something from that person dictated the success that I have now?
Some speakers I heard, I realized I do not want to be in financial management. I do not want to work for some companies, which is helpful, you know, kind of hearing their day and what it looks like. There was one person in particular, he was a founder of a potato chip company, and he was right there in Seattle, and he told a story about baking potato chips for his family and then friends and then making them in his garage. And it's the total garage startup story. Ended up selling the business for $100 million. I remember like looking at him and going, I could do that. For some reason, it seemed very approachable. Like as an average dude, just kind of winged it, bootstrapped it, figured it out, kind of got, you know, hard work, a little bit of luck. But I think what struck me too is he was playful and fun. Like he enjoyed the journey of business. And the way he described the business story wasn't boring. He made it sound exciting. He made it sound fun and he was passionate about it. And I remember leaving and telling some friends, like, maybe I want to be an entrepreneur. I think that kind of clicked with me. I don't know what it is yet. I don't know what I want to do, but I like what I'm hearing from that speaker. I remember that.
Yeah, I want to highlight that. I think that's fascinating because you first started and you said, I went to the military. That's not for me. That's not going to work. I was listening about financial services. That's not for me. The internship that you did, that's not for me. And then you hear an entrepreneur talking about potato chips and you're like, that's for me. And I like that process because it shows that it wasn't that you weren't open-minded. It's just that you were being very aware of yourself and saying, this isn't going to fit with myself, and having the awareness and the courage to say no to pathways that were presented to you.
Totally agree, Dave. And I look at it like a long hallway with doors. And college is a great season to like open a door up, check it out. Like, what do you think of accounting? Like, it's not for me. Or what do you think of law? You know, what do you think of science? And each of the doors you can open up to explore and experience and close it and then go down the hall. But some you open up, like for me, it was, I found myself very attracted to marketing and entrepreneurship and sales. And another speaker came and they were an agency, a creative ad agency. And it was like kind of a Mad Men vibe. And I remember thinking, oh, they can do creative work for clients and marketing and stories. And like, they get paid for that. I just, I remember just being inspired, thinking like, man, can you imagine going to a cool office and making fun marketing stories for companies and you get paid for it? I'm like,
yeah.
So those things helped me kind of fine tune the directionality of what might be interesting, even though I didn't have it figured out yet. But I think it was helpful to fine tune that and little pattern recognition about what's clicking and what's not.
Yeah. And typically I don't do this with every interview, Paul, but I think because of the nature of the industry that you're in, and because I know that you've provided so much career advice, I know that you've done things too, where you've just provided free career advice, right? So I want to pause for a second. And let's say that someone is listening to this, they're young, they're going into college, they're in college, or they're just getting out of it. What would you say is a mistake that people make? And advice that you would give to someone who's at that stage of their career?
The number one mistake I find people make is they just get stuck with what their parents did or what a friend did or a neighbor did. All they really know is what their parents did or what they saw on TV as careers. They haven't really thought about what other opportunities and jobs are out there. And so I think it's a little bit about expanding your scope about what jobs exist, what industries exist. And some of that can be online lookups, like what companies exist, what do they do? What also, I think there's alumni and interns and friends. When you start thinking about it, you have a buddy who owns a dry cleaner or someone that is a scientist, and you start realizing you actually know people who do these jobs. And if you're a high schooler or a college student and you call someone up and say, you know, hey, Dave, can I buy you coffee and learn what you do? I mean, you get one phone call every 5-10 years like that and you take them out. So I think learning from that is my number one thing, is just kind of expand your mind what might be out there as a step one.
I don't think people do that enough. I know that I'm part of an alumni association and I've got my name on the list where I'll take someone to lunch. And it's shocking to me, A, how that's not used very often. And then I would say, B, when they do use it, I don't feel like they're prepared. I don't feel like they're asking the right questions, and they rarely ever follow up on it. I can think of one individual, maybe two, that did that and they've checked in with me and they've reported back and I want to hear their progress. Most of them take that opportunity and then they just never come back to it. They never return and report what they've done.
In a similar way, I'm an alumni, happy to chat with anyone. I think in 25 years, I've had two call me up and great conversations and helped them out. I think the second step, I would say, once you expand your mind, what could be out there, the second step is to test drive it. And this is a classic story. Someone says they want to be a school teacher. They spend tens of thousands of dollars for college and they show up to the classroom and realize they don't like it. When if they had just spent one day in a classroom, they probably would have figured that out. So
yeah,
it's really cheap and you don't need to know anything when you're in high school or college. They're not expecting any knowledge, but just to shadow someone for a day or hang out just to see if you even like that industry or role.
Volunteer.
Yeah. For free. Like just, yeah. It's super helpful. And I think if it's an internship or just hang out for a day, or I'll buy you a coffee and just walk in the office, you learn a lot very quickly. And I think there's something about then trusting your gut. But I think that it can help winnow the field, what may make sense or not.
Yeah, that's so true. I remember doing a brief volunteer stint at a hospital and watching everything that was going on. And there's that question in the back of mind. You know, I think a lot of people are like, maybe I should be a doctor, right? And then I did that and I'm around it. And I'm seeing all these different things happening. And then I remember being in this closet, we were getting supplies and there was a medical book there. And I'm looking at the book and I was like, nope, this doesn't match the way my brain works. But without that volunteer experience, I wouldn't have known that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the most valuable things in going to college. It's not the book learning. I mean, I'm sure there's great stuff there, but with online learning and videos, you could learn almost the same material. It's the people you hang out with. It's like the people I spent time with in my dorm or fraternity and the relationships you build, but also all the alumni. You're buying access to an alumni network of people who give credibility, but also opportunities. They'll happy to meet with you, happy to help you, happy to do internships. They're the most likely chance for your first job because you can play the alumni fist bump and it gets you in the door a little further. And I think that's what you're paying for. And to not take advantage of that is missing a big point of why you're there.
Yeah. And I also want to pause and say too, this isn't just limited to people in college. I think this is something that anyone at any stage in their career can reach out and give themselves new opportunities and new perspectives. So let's go back to the story. Where did recruiting enter in? You know, last we talked about it, you were thinking about entrepreneurship. You were thinking about being a madman, being a marketer. Where did recruiting enter into the picture?
So my first job out of school, I did sell TV radio ads. I did explore that. And it was this entrepreneurial guy, his name's Terry. It was just him and me. And I would go door to door saying, what is your marketing strategy? And I literally, okay, this is old school. Like,
yeah,
like I would have a list of companies and I would literally knock on the door like a copier salesman and just ask about their marketing and strategies and how they do their spend. I'm like, can you imagine having your face on TV or radio? And like, oh, and just play to their ego. And I would sell TV radio ads and we'd get them on the show. And do we know if it worked or not? Like, I don't know, but their ego felt great. And it was probably better than print in the paper. And so that was my first job, was just commission, coffee for closers, knock on doors, track things down. But We wrote ads. It was fun to hear some ad on the radio or TV you wrote. And I realized I was good at sales. I'm like, man, I'm good at sales. I got this grit. I read every sales book that existed, I think. When you're on commission, you get motivated very quickly. But also some suffering. Like, I just was not making enough. The industry was weird. It was not at all what I expected. It wasn't as glamorous. It wasn't as fun or sexy or as maybe I thought it was on the outside. But I realized I enjoyed sales and I also enjoyed businesses and I liked the variety of business. Maybe I'm just a little ADD, but just I enjoy talking to a manufacturer and then a hospital and then a car dealer. Like, I enjoyed the variety. And so I learned it from that. So then I used my alumni network. There's actually both jobs came through my alumni tip there. I did follow my own advice and I got a role. I needed to just make rent, to be honest. I was not doing as good. It was a low, hard moment. And this will happen in life, in the hero's journey, because I believe our life is a hero's journey. And it's not the straight line that people think it is. It's this up, down, you have peaks and valleys. And the year after college was a valley year for me. It was a depressing year. As a gal I thought I was going to marry, she dumped me. I was living with a weird roommate in Tacoma. And this job wasn't working out. And my parents were giving me career advice, which is bad. And I just felt like life was much harder and it wasn't as successful. It was really a hard season, I think, to go through that. And that will happen in life. But it was a good chance to, for me to reflect on what is important. And I think I got my from values, from a focus, and I think a redirection that I still look on today that I think got me back on track. And I feel that was a very interesting timing around when I fell into recruiting.
Was that self-inflicted? Like the adversity that you were encountering looking back, do you feel like there were things that you were doing that were creating that situation?
I think it's a mix. Some was self-inflicted. I chose a job that in the end wasn't a fit. And I realized the person I was working for wasn't as good of a a manager leader that maybe I thought. There's some things that, you know, I realized in my own life. But I think that's also, I think I thought too highly of myself. I think I thought I was going to be invincible. I thought I could do anything. And so there's a bit of an invincibility. There's probably a little bit of I deserve things. I think there's a part about getting that knocked out and being humbled early on. And it was having a failure, hard season was good because it did build me up. It did get me recharged, refreshed. And I think it's easy to get distracted on secondary things. And I think I was letting that happen in my life.
What do you mean by secondary things?
I was wanting success too quick. I was looking for the shortcut. I thought if I could just do this quickly, I could make a lot of money. And if I had a lot of money, it said something about I'm successful and I'm awesome. And I was building my own personal brand. I was building myself to be the hero of the story. Mm. And I think end of the day in life, you need to find something that has more meaning. Because when you have yourself as a hero of the story, it leads to two outcomes. Either you fail, which means you're very depressed, or you actually have success and you get very prideful. And I realized that that's what was happening is I was getting depressed or I was getting too prideful. And I realized that both led to not good outcomes.
That's fascinating right there. That's a great insight that I hope people pay attention to. And I think it's a natural tendency for people who are young to think, I've got to go so fast. I'm going to be ahead of the curve. I'm going to retire early. I'm going to do that, all that thing. There's nothing wrong with having those goals. But at the same time, when the time frame is so condensed, when you think, oh, you know, I'm 21, I'm going to retire at the age of 30, you're creating unrealistic expectations for yourself. You're putting way too much pressure on yourself, where if you just gave yourself permission to take a little longer, success is probably more likely to come earlier.
Mm-hmm. And I think in kind of picking up that story, I had to realize that and I had to hit rock bottom to realize that. And I think there's a season of learning, listening that is good in life. And that's the moment when I let go and said, okay, I'm giving up the shift in my philosophy and approach in life. And I don't think it was coincidence that I got a job the next week and it was helping injured workers get back to work. If you're a carpenter and you blow your back out, you go to labor and industries and you get sent to a private company to help you get back on track. There's a bunch of psychology majors I was working with, and it was interesting, but I just needed a job, to be honest. I was just trying to find something to get back on track. But here's when I fell into it, is this the unexpected connection is the owner, Pete, and his son had this executive recruiting division because he used to be the head of HR for Weyerhaeuser. They're a big wood products company. And so they did this thing called executive recruiting. And I thought only the military had recruiters. I didn't know what recruiters were. The fact that companies paid recruiters and like, is that legal? Like,
sure.
What do you do? And so I got a chance to learn about that. And dealing with injured workers was depressing because I found what they were doing was inspiring. And it was a weird reward system in the counseling space because the longer you did it, the better you were meant you could get higher level and harder cases, which I thought was a really bizarre reward system. But I saw an executive search, the longer you did it, the better searches you worked on, the more you got paid and the more lifestyle you had. And I said, okay, I like that track better. And that's when I approached them and said, I want to try this executive recruiting. And they laughed at me because I was only 23. You're too young for this. And I said, give me a shot. And they did.
And then what did you do with that shot? How did you prove yourself?
They had one search. I said, okay, we'll give you a chance to fill this general manager for a truss manufacturing plant. I think it was in California. I had no idea what I was talking about. This is recruiting in the mid 90s, by the way. There's no internet. So I literally had the wood products directory. I would open it up from A to Z and I would call down the list and phone call and try to figure out who the general manager is, get past the secretary, ask them to mail me a resume. And I would then mail the resume to the clients. And so I got my first commission on my very first deal and it worked. I kind of wonder if that first deal hadn't happened, if they would have given me a second shot. But I think it was kind of a one shot. I think they were honestly expecting me to fail and they just wanted me to try it to prove it wasn't a fit. But when I was successful and I got it filled, they said, well, we'll give you another one. And then next thing you know, I was doing that for a couple of years.
So you mentioned how that process is, you were calling people. Do you or did you have any fear associated with that or any discomfort? Or was it just, hey, I'm just going to start calling people? I'm always curious when someone is able to do that because for me, it's foreign and difficult.
Oh, it is. It goes to all your fears. And I think that prior year I had spent knocking on doors in person made a phone seem a lot less scary. I felt a little more distance, but I got used to cold calling before. And after a while, I made a game of it. It just became playful where I tried different things. I tried different approaches, kind of A-B tested what worked, but didn't. I really looked at it more as a game to play and figure out what's working. And I didn't look at them as rejecting me, just maybe my message wasn't working or my approach wasn't working. At a certain point, I realized a numbers game too. Like you just got to call so many to get to your pipeline and number. And it's a little bit of a rush. I don't know. There's a little bit of an adrenaline rush, you know, when you go out of your comfort zone and you make that call. But then when you track down the person and they said they're interested and you end up placing them, it's like, wow. It's like little Jerry Maguire, you know, a little taste of that.
Sure. You mentioned something really quickly, just briefly define for those who are unfamiliar. When you say A-B test, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, A-B test, it's like taking two approaches. Like approach A may be, I leave a vague message about, hey, I have a business conversation I want to talk to you about. Give me a call back. Vague. And that option B is, I'm recruiting for this general manager for a truss plant. Here's exactly the details. If you're curious, let me know. Here's my number. And so I tried both approaches and which one worked. And I found over time that B worked.
Right. Many times, multiple reps of each.
Yeah. So I try each one 20 times, let's say. And then after I would see that, okay, one seems to be more effective and then maybe more detail. Then I would play with how much detail to give or I'd practice different hooks. And that's fun. I always just kept playing and testing different ways. And after time, you start realizing like, ooh, this works.
Okay, good. I think it's such a powerful principle. It's a great thing to use. And I don't think many people understand that sort of scientific method approach to sales and marketing where you're comparing the different outcomes of ways of doing things. So when did it transition into you now are a leader or you're owning your own company? How did you reach that point in your career?
It's funny. I had a full year and a half experience. And I thought to myself, well, I'm definitely qualified to do my own company. Which is pretty funny. And at the time, I started picking up more tech work because I had a bunch of friends from college who were tech recruiters at Microsoft and other companies who were hiring like crazy. And there was very few recruiters that even existed. And so I was able to pick up some work. So I launched my own search firm called Northwest Search. It was out of my house in Seattle. And it was just upstairs. And my wife worked with me for a while, helping me out as well. And it was funny. Having a good name, Northwest Search, everyone thought they had heard of me. Like, oh, I think I've heard of you guys. Or, oh, yeah, you've been around a while. And it always kind of cracked me up that picking a good name does help because they think more highly of you. Than
right, yeah.
So we kind of gained some early credibility. I got lucky on that one. But just start out doing contingent more. That's if you place someone, they pay you more mid-level hires. And like I was doing network admin searches for Microsoft. Like I was an early client. And here's something, a little Columbo approach. You know, Columbo always asks questions.
Yeah. Now, for those who are not familiar, Columbo is an old school, you're kind of dating us both here, Paul, but old school detective show where he'd act like he didn't know too much, but he was actually really sneaky and very skilled at what he was doing, right?
So I was an authentic Columbo because I didn't know that much. I was actually sitting down with some hiring managers. And here's what I found is that, and I kind of stumbled on this, is that what HR gave me was, here's 20 soul-sucking tasks you can do, but you don't know why. And it's soulless. It doesn't actually describe the role. And no one really understands what it means. And I was just sitting there talking to a hiring manager and saying, well, help me understand what the job actually is. And what does someone actually do? And what's a win look like? Or what are you looking for? And what's worked? What has in the past? And how do you know someone's great? And just asking these open-ended questions, I would have this rich conversation with the hiring manager, and I would just write down what they said. Mm. And I would rewrite the job description to make it more interesting. And I think that helped me be more effective because actually people would see it as a more interesting story. It would help self-select who's a fit, who is not. And I was more clear what they're looking for. And so just me working in my upstairs extra bedroom in my house, I became like the top three external recruiters Microsoft worked with out of the gate. I think it's just because I was doing those things that no one else was doing.
Let's highlight that for a second. It also reminds me of, and I think he talks about Columbo too, is Sandler Sales. Are you a student of that, Paul?
I love Sandler.
Yeah, really interesting book. You can't teach a kid to ride a bicycle in a seminar. Am I getting that? Such a terrible name for a book. But one of the things he talks about, and it sounds like you were doing in this, is I think he calls it dummy up. But it's basically like the problem with people in sales, and this is kind of a sales type industry that you're in, they know too much and the knowledge that they have gets in the way. Mm. And because it gets in the way, they stop asking questions, they stop attending to the customer's needs, and it becomes all about them. But if you can always behave sort of like you are a novice, even when you know what you're doing, just asking questions and really learning more and always be learning, that's what leads to sales. Mm-hmm. Because you're showing interest in the other person and you're getting things right because you're paying attention to what they're telling you.
And while today we've leveled up and do more CEO searches for bigger companies, it's fundamentally the same thing I did that first year. I found just being intellectually curious about who they are, what they do, their space, understanding what's worked, what hasn't. It's like a puzzle you're solving and also how it affects them. This is a question I find people don't ask. Like, how does this VP sales not being there affect you? And if you had a great one, what would a win look like? How would that make you feel? And you can kind of get to the emotions that they're feeling about how it helps the organization win. And there needs to be a bigger 10x win about this role to justify paying us to go find someone. So I'm kind of looking for the pain being 10 times higher than my fee. So I think looking for, you know, a reason why I'm doing this, an ROI, but also reminding them why we're doing this. And I found also a lot of recruiters didn't do that. I kind of talk business first and recruiting second.
Why are they doing this? Why does a company need a recruiting firm to help them find people?
Good question. they hire us because we have an expertise in filling a certain role at that level that they don't have internally. Because usually internal recruiter doesn't have experience filling CFOs or CEOs or head of engineering. So we have expertise, or we just have the bandwidth to go deeper on it than they do. And I think just having a third party perspective on it is very helpful, because at times it is very consultative. Maybe they're stuck, not sure why someone didn't work out or got fired or left. It's a little bit of therapy where you're just helping them, you know, think creatively about what they could do, and also look at new approaches, where someone could be today in talent. And so we kind of give them new ways of thinking about the role that they hadn't. So it's kind of like the Navy SEALs of recruiting. We're like, we're the ones that go in, we're like, okay, this is important. We're expensive, but it's important. And we have a high profile role for you to fill.
Well, and the cost of not making a great hire is tremendous. You hire the wrong person, and typically it's going to take you months to realize that, and months to separate yourself from that. That's tens of thousands of dollars that it's costing a company when they make a bad hire.
You hire the wrong CEO, you can lose important team members, you can lose clients, you could change the whole course of the business in 12, 18 months, you know, good or bad. It has a impact and directionality. It's like, well, yeah, what's the benefit Michael Jordan brought to his team? Or like, or I think in sports, we understand this. Like, okay, yeah, this star player had a significant impact in their own production, but the whole team. Business, in a similar way, I think that there's a bit of a star effect. If you get an A player, they can really move the needle, and they can inspire people to join them and level up the whole team, not just their own production.
Yeah. The stakes are so tremendously high for executives that you really need to invest in that kind of assistance. Okay. So going back to your story, so you started your own recruiting firm, and it eventually became Heard Freed Hearts.
Yes. I did that for a couple of years. This is also in 2000. All my friends are becoming millionaires in startups, and I'm like, I'm missing out. So I joined a startup for a year called Startup Academy. Basically, it was a accelerator think tank. You see, like, kind of like Y Combinator is today.
Mm-hmm.
We worked with 30 startups. We took equity. I was part of the team to help ramp them up. And this was my paid MBA. We had strategy sessions of where they are, where they're going. We put them through ropes courses. I mean, it was really interesting, mental toughness. It was a really fascinating experience. Just the dot-com crash happened, and all of a sudden, all these tech companies went away, and you learn the value of cash over equity in that moment. I think some are learning that again today.
Yeah.
You learn from history. And that's the moment where I loved it. It was super fun. I'd still be there today, to be honest. It was great. But that's the moment where I had two friends, Jim Hurd and Kevin Hartz, and we're young friends in recruiting and same neighborhood. And they were in a tech company at the time, a public company. And we talked about forming our own thing, because they saw they were paying all these out-of-town recruiters who would fly into Seattle from New York or Chicago or LA. And they would complain that no one wanted to move to Seattle. It was really hard. They didn't know the area. And he ended up filling half the roles himself. And he's like, man, we could do our own search firm. There's just a huge opportunity here. There's not many competitors. There's huge demand. And it was around the living room, we decided to take a leap of faith to do this. And that's when we started Heard Freed Hearts. It was in 2001.
Wow. So at this moment, that's 22 years that that's been around.
That sounds old, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, anyone makes mistakes as they grow in their career. But to be an entrepreneur, especially, is to make a lot of mistakes. And to attempt things that do not work out. So as you think about those early years of HFH, what is a story that illustrates a mistake that you look back on now and you're like, wow, I learned a lot from that?
During those times when we were first starting out, you just want anyone to work with you. And I think we had some tech recruiting experience. So we doubled down on the tech industry, which was super hot in Seattle, and we rode that. The mistake we made was that we put too much emphasis on that. And I think that, well, it was good for a while to get some initial clients. When the recession happened in 2008, we were stuck with like 90% of our business being tech. And we hadn't not diversified into other sectors or other areas. And we were stuck. There was definitely moments like, I wasn't sure if we were going to make it. And we thought, man, we should have thought through this more. We should have thought about stress test if this thing went away or what else would be out there. And it forced us to look at other industries, part out of just desperation, but we found out like, well, healthcare is hiring. Oh, nonprofit, the Gates Foundation, they're hiring. And oh, look, manufacturing is hiring. And all these other industries we kind of stumbled on. And in that season, out of need. And then also we stumbled on recruiters. We actually made our first hires during that first recession because people were available to talk to. And we realized also maybe we should have gone for it more. Maybe we should have hired the team during that season. It was much more of a lifestyle play the first 7 years. And so I think we came out of that, and it was a later story, but 2008, we came out the backside of that, the largest executive search firm in Seattle, which sounded really cool, but it was like five of us because everyone else was gone.
Okay.
And so we came out of that, the largest exec search firm and much more breadth across industries, which helped us on the journey, you know, since then, you know, the last 15 years, just really having breadth in different industries and different roles, which has become what we're known for.
It's interesting you bring that up because that was also something that we were talking about before we started the interview. I was just kind of catching up with what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Is that mindset of, if you can survive the hard times, if the business structure is built in the right way, then the other companies that aren't prepared, they won't continue. They won't survive. But if you survive when others don't, then you become even better, either through acquisitions or because of their old customers are coming to you. Can you talk just a little bit about how you've been able to weather several economic storms and why you keep getting bigger after each of them?
Yeah, we're kind of middle one right now, to be honest. I mean, it's kind of fresh where I think the tech sector definitely gone pulled back, you know, with investments and interest rates.
Yes.
And so I think that we're feeling that right now again. And I think the diversity of industries, most search firms will specialize just in one thing. We just do marketers for manufacturing. We just do finance, you know, for tech. They get real hyper-focused. We unusually have said, we'll work in healthcare and nonprofit and manufacturing and family-run business and private equity and work across these areas. I think that gave us a breadth that has definitely helped us a little more resilient. We have a lot more breadth of clients. We're not having just one or two big clients, you know, that we're dependent on. We're much more stable with a mix of clients. And I think we've also realized that the ideal client oftentimes is that mid-size family-run business or private equity-backed, you know, maybe 20 million to 100 million. Maybe they make widgets and no one knows about them, but it's a profitable, solid business that not everyone's chasing. And so we've chosen some sectors like manufacturing, nonprofit. Alaska has been a sector for us as well. A lot of searches in Alaska.
Interesting.
Where no one else is really chasing. And so we kind of go where people aren't chasing the same deals and they're used to work with recruiters in the Midwest or East Coast, and they're so happy to talk to someone based in the Northwest. We realize that's a huge opportunity. And I think it's also a piece of just being grateful. I mean, it's like, just take care of the clients you have. That's your best business development. Make them happy, be different, have a great experience.
Yes.
It's easy sometimes to get caught up in the shiny new object of the new logo, the new client you're chasing. When there's someone who's already paid you, already knows you, already likes you, why don't you spend more time with them?
Yes, I love that too, because from a marketing perspective, you can spend, let's just say $1,000 trying to get a new customer. But if you spend $1,000 on your existing customer and do more for them and give them a little extra, then they'll refer business to you and they'll stay loyal. So yeah, I'm always a fan of investing in your existing customers first, not just in money, but in time and attention. I feel like that's the best return on investment you can make.
I think the other thing that's really helped us is just being a great place to work. The culture, we were before COVID, we were very flexible on hours, on lifestyle and commission structure, which creates flexibility. And we want people to be successful in their personal life and in things that they enjoy. And we'll say like, this isn't the end game. Like work is here to make money. So you can go do the things you want to do in your life. But the purpose of life isn't work. It's a tool. So we say that, you know, and we want them, whether it's in the family, travel or some adventures or dreams or goals. We make a connection with the work we're doing to achieving that. And I think we've had an unusually high stickiness of people who want to enjoy working with us and stick around, because we tell them when they join our firm, like, this should be the last job you have if you want to stay in executive search, because you get paid well, we'll treat you well, and it's a good lifestyle. And there's always little moments you can make more money with someone else. But in the end, the long tail is you're more successful in life, not just in business. And I think people value that more, the time and the flexibility.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're such a great example of that, Paul. And that's probably a good place to make that transition where we start kind of moving on the tail end of this. But I know that your family, your wife, your daughter are a huge part of your life. That's part of the reason also why I wanted to interview you, because I like talking to people who have achieved multifaceted success. Let's first of all talk about your relationship with your wife. Where did she come into the picture? And what role has that relationship with her played into your career success?
My wife, Rachel, married 26 years, and we actually met growing up in Bend. So one of those met growing up, major high school sweetheart. And she was a great business partner with me. I always viewed us as a team. God always has a sense of humor to marry your opposite. And so she covers my blind spots on life and in business. And so it was a really good balance for us in that very first company to help the business operations. But she's always been just my encourager, my support. I think she's kind of helping the chaos I think I can create around that. But I think we've been a really good team. And we haven't worked together. I mean, outside that first year when we were getting going. But I think it's been a very good team approach. And she's giving me the encouragement, support, the nudges as I need at times. But I think also just end of the day, it's about the family. I think having some health and the family, and that's what inspires me to work. It's not just making a few more bucks.
Structurally, how do you make that happen? How do you make sure that you're taking time for your family and those relationships?
This is good. And this gets to something that most people in their life, they work a lot and they try to fit the other stuff and what's left over.
Mm-hmm.
Here's that type of work. And with time left over, I'll try to work out, or I'll try to have some family or kid time or friend time, but it's leftovers and it's not your first and your best. And I think that's very common. And what I've tried to do in my life and model and encourage others to do is reverse engineer the life you want. Meaning, like, what are the hours you actually want to work during the week? And you know, certain time blocks around work hours. And then intentionally on the calendar, putting in things, you know, from health to family time, and just really time blocking your priorities. This is something you taught me, Dave, but it's making sure that, you know, your priorities are reflected on your calendar. And oftentimes they're not. And I think that's been a good step. There's also just a thing where it's just a leap of faith to say it's worth it now versus I hope it's worth it someday. I see a lot of people putting in the grind, and there's times and seasons in life you have to do that. So I'm not discounting it, but
sure.
But some people get caught in this, hope it's worth it someday, hopefully, kind of just wish that it all comes together. And you see them just grinding and they're physically unhealthy and their family suffers and they don't have a good support network. And you see this hit the wall, and I see the burnout happen, and a lot of friends and a lot of entrepreneurs. And I just made the intentional choice where it's worth it now. We chose to move to Bend, Oregon 7 years ago. It's awesome resort town. If you've been here, come check it out. It's 300 days of your sunshine.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Half hour radius. There's a lot of outdoor adventure, but also we have family here. And we decided to make the leap of faith now and not quote when we retired. And our daughter was 4 at the time. She's now 11. So similar age as your youngest.
Yeah.
And so we wanted her to grow up here. And last year, we also did a 4-day work week. I don't advertise this, but you know, I try to take Fridays off. And I found that time for intentional play to be with friends, hike a mountain, go skiing. You're kind of always on as an entrepreneur. So have that time just to relax, be creative, be playful. Some of my best ideas have come skiing. You're not in a strategy session on the whiteboard at work.
Yeah.
You know, I think, and just talking through something with another friend or laughing about silly things you could do. And all of a sudden you stumble on something like, Dave, that's a great idea. We should do that.
I love it. Yeah. You're a poster child for what I teach in my book, The Power of Having Fun. In fact, you just use the phrases from it, right? The culture of wish is that it'll be worth it someday, hopefully, right? Mm-hmm. All this hard work and effort. Instead, you want to make it the culture of win, worth it now. And everything that you're doing is worth it now. And that you really are such a great example of that, Paul, because I know that for many years now, you are living now the kind of life you want to live. You're not fully retired, and you don't have to be fully retired to live that kind of life. And I think that's where people get a little mixed up with it.
Yes. And there's a certain curve where I think more money does make life easier, but it starts peaking and going the other direction, ironically. And I found in my life and others, just the time and the flexibility and the freedom is more valuable and more why I'm an entrepreneur is those things. And the last thing I'd say about on the life balance of the community, don't go it alone. I think this is a classic mistake people make is maybe it's the American thing. Like I'm going to white knuckle it. I'm going to do it all myself. And that's hard. I found I was doing that in my business. I joined a group called Entrepreneur Organization, EO. It's kind of like a CEO mastermind group. You meet once a month. You talk about highs and lows, personal and work, and people share stories. But it's part therapy, part strategy. But you realize you're not the only one going through stuff. You're not alone on ideas. And you have this, like, this power group to help you in that. I also found that through my church, we have a community group that meets once a week, and you have tacos and beer, and you talk about life and marriage and kids, and you realize you're not the only ones going through struggles. And I think it's about going through life together. And I think that's where a lot of your care and generosity and to help others find their paths and be together. I think that's where people I've seen be successful, they typically have some sort of mastermind group or success group, personal or work, that helps them along the journey. And I would encourage your kids and other listeners in life to create that. And you can pay for it, or you can just get people together to hang out intentionally for free. But there's ways to do that. And that's something I wish I had done earlier.
That's a fantastic principle. Well, Paul, thank you for your generosity with your time here. I know you've got a lot of demands on your time, so unfortunately, we need to wrap it up. But with every episode, we always do this. We provide some summaries of potential actions, right? You know, Paul, that it's not about just having a conversation. It's about action. It's about what you do. I know that's who you are. So what I'm suggesting to those who have been listening is let's look for a way that you can make Paul's success story a part of your success story. So I'm going to share three possible actions. And Paul, I'd like you to chime in with one or two at the end of something specific, tactical that someone can do this week, right now, not something in the future. Sound good?
Sounds great.
Okay. So the first one, I'm going back to the beginning of the story, which is that expressing belief in others. And in this case, we're using Paul's family, in particular his mom, as an example, but telling people and letting them know, hey, you can do this, you can succeed. I think that is a really powerful influence. In fact, the more of these interviews that I've seen, the more I've realized, man, hearing that at a young age or hearing that when you're impressionable and you're starting out your career is powerful. So this is kind of more of an action that you can do with someone else, but express belief in someone else. Think of someone in your life that could benefit from that kind of positivity and let them know that you're confident that they can achieve, and look for things that you can compliment them on when they do it. Second principle that stands out there, gosh, there were so many, Paul, so I'm just having to kind of pick one of many. Try lots of different things. Expand your scope. Paul mentioned it's easy to get stuck with what your parents did or stuck with something that you see on TV. Try lots of different things. Do internships, volunteer somewhere, and try something out. Heck, you could just like spend time watching YouTube videos about a day in the life of a lawyer or whatever it is, but try to expand your horizons and look at different options. And then as Paul did, ask yourself, is this for me? Does this work for me? That will help make it easier for you to find the thing that works best for you. And then I want to wrap up my actions with the last thing you talked about, which is reverse engineer your life for the kind of lifestyle that you want to have. Not how many hours you work and then you fill in the rest with what's positive, but instead saying, how much time do I want to have for my family? How much time am I going to spend on my hobbies? Build that structure and then put work around that. I have seen it over and over and over with my clients, with people I've consulted. That works. And you do better at work and you're happier. So that's a possible action. Paul, what would you suggest to someone listening to this?
I like all those. Those are great ideas.
They came from you.
I would add, don't go it alone.
Yes.
You know, is there someone you could have intentional connection with, whether it's in business or life, to not do the journey alone? And I think you both will benefit from it. And I think in approaching that, it's not what do I get out of you and what's my return on my time with you, but more of a giving generosity mindset. Like when you say, how can I help you succeed in work and life? And there's this mindset to give first and to care and to be generous. Because I believe too much has been given, much is expected. And it's not about getting stuff, but it's about more giving things away, more time and money, give it away. Later you start looking back on life. And so there's a generosity mindset with others that I would encourage you to have that maybe I didn't mention, but in this community, it's not about what can I get from you? What can I pull from you? But how can I help you? And what goes around comes around. And I think people will see the genuine nature of that and they'll actually be inspired to help you more. So it's not trying to be transactional, not trying to game this, but your heart truly is that way. I think it does come back tenfold.
Oh, that's fantastic. Beautiful principle. Thanks for sharing that, Paul. And thank you for generously sharing your time and your story with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave. And a thank you to you. You had a huge life change for me over the years. So your principles, your inspiration, your encouragement have been huge for me and my family. So a personal thank you to you as well and all the work you do.
Oh, thank you, Paul. It's an honor to know you.
Likewise.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. Remember, it's not as much about what you heard, but it's about the action that you take. So do something about what you heard from Paul's story today, and you'll make his success story a part of your success story. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Dave Crenshaw Success Show, hosted by my dad, Dave Crenshaw, and produced by Invaluable Incorporated. Research and assistant production by Victoria Bidez. Sound editing by Mark Lamarjazy. Voiceover by me, Darcy Crenshaw. And the music is by Ryan Brady via Pond 5 Licensing. Please subscribe to the Dave Crenshaw Success Project on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to get your podcasts. If you have a suggestion for someone my dad might like to interview, please send it to guests@davecrenshaw.com. And please don't forget to leave us a 5-star review. See you next time.